Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
You are listening to NPR News. I'm Angela Davis. One of the ways Minnesota is changing is this. Far more teenagers are transgender or gender nonconforming than previously thought. A study released last year that looked at 9th and 11th graders in Minnesota found 3% are transgender or gender nonconforming, meaning they don't always self-identify as the sex they were assigned at birth. The rates are higher than a California study released last year, estimating 0.7% of teenagers are transgender. But as gender and sexual identity have evolved, many teachers and families are struggling. This hour, a school teacher turned advocate and a pediatrician specializing in gender health are joining me here in the studio to talk about how to navigate talking with your children about gender and how to create an environment that is inclusive for all students at school. I also want to take your questions, hear your stories. What conversations have you had around gender identity with your children? Give us a call at 651-227-6000, or you can certainly tweet me as well. I'm at Angela Davis, NPR. Let me introduce my guest today. We have Dr. Angela Cade Gepford here. She is a pediatrician and medical director of Children's Minnesota Center for Gender Health. They're in Minneapolis, correct? Hi, Dr. Gepford. Good to meet you. We also have Kelly Holstein here. Kelly is the director of educational equity at Outfront Minnesota. Most recently, Kelly taught English at Takata Learning Center in Shakopee, which is an alternative school. She is a recent Minnesota Teacher of the Year. Good to see you again, Kelly.
Good to see you. Thank you for having me.
First, let's just get to, like, why is it important to have this conversation, the value of talking about this? Why is it important for everyone to have a good understanding of gender identity?
Well, I think, you know, just like you mentioned, close to 3% of Minnesota students identify as transgender, gender diverse. So it's a conversation that a lot of families are having. And it's a relatively new conversation for a lot of families. It's not something that I talked about necessarily growing up with a lot of my peers or with my parents. So I think a lot of parents, grandparents, friends, teachers are unsure of how to have the conversation. So it's really important that we're learning together how to do that better.
It's a new conversation, but it's not a new issue. So when we were growing up, were these issues that people were thinking about, but just not vocalizing?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that there certainly have been transgender and gender diverse kids and adults for a very long time. But we now have a society that's allowing that conversation to happen more. So we're having kids feeling more comfortable having conversations with their parents, with their teachers, with their peers. And so we need to be ready to have that conversation with them.
Kelly, why do we need to talk about gender identity?
I really believe that every student deserves a safe and respectful and caring environment so that they can get into their learning brains and be able to get an education. And so as educators, we need to create that environment so students have what they need so that they can get what, I mean, you know, a lot of people talk about Maslow's before Bloom's. So making mm-hmm. sure that their emotional needs are being met so that they feel safe so that then they can learn. Because our students need their diplomas. I used to be a case manager with folks who dropped out of high school, and it's really hard in our society to function without a high school diploma. So we need to create environments where every student can get what they need.
Because it's a distraction for them as students. They can't focus on their academics if their most basic needs are not being met.
Exactly. And if they're not being treated with respect by other students or by educators, and there's a lot of well-intentioned educators out there that might be making some choices that are making it difficult for mm-hmm. our kids who express their selves in different ways.
I want to make sure that everyone who's listening, and I want to make sure that I have a good understanding of the terms that are commonly used to discuss gender. And so, Dr. Gepford, what are we talking about when we say gender identity?
So gender identity is the sense that you have of whether you're male, female, or something in between. And it typically, for most of us, is something that is quite innate and that develops very young. So, you know, for the three of us sitting in the room, we probably can't remember when we first knew that we were boys or girls. And most of us can't. And mm-hmm. for kids, it's something that really develops quite young for them, usually between the ages of 2 and 4. And then kids learn how to express that identity over time as they age.
And so for a young child, how would a young child express that?
Well, for cisgender kids or kids whose gender is the same that they were assigned at birth, they often don't necessarily express it. Or kids say to that, parents say to them, "You're a boy." And they say back, "Yes, I am." But for some kids who are transgender, when they start to realize that the world is saying that they're a boy, but inside they feel like they're a girl, they do start to express that. And they will say, "I'm in the wrong body," or, "No, I'm a girl," or, "Why is everyone calling me a boy when really I'm a girl?" And something feels off to them. And so they can start to express it even at quite a young age.
And that's the typical phrasing, what you just said.
I think actually gender identity and expression can come in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. And some kids will express it in that way and express it quite young. Some kids develop some questions about their gender identity as they move through their childhood and into mm-hmm. adolescence. And puberty is a big time when a lot of kids have questions about all aspects of their identity, really. And for some children, their gender identity.
And Kelly, how do you describe gender identity when someone asks you, like, what are you talking about?
I agree with Angela's definition that it's the person's internal sense of self. And then we distinguish between that and gender expression, which you also referenced, which is the way people communicate their gender within a given culture. And it's really different from culture to culture. Long hair can mean something different in a different culture. The clothes you wear, the way you express yourself can be really, you know, gendered differently in different cultures. And gender expression really is a social construct. And so it's what society has decided is feminine, what society has decided is masculine. And so that's really important to consider too. And we have folks who their gender expression might not match their gender identity, and they might identify as gender nonconforming. I'm one of those humans.
I have to stop you there because I have a lot of questions. Yeah. So the terminology that is used, so there are three words I think you just used right there that I want to make sure we stop and define. So gender expression, that is how we dress,
how we talk, the peers that we choose to hang out with, the activities that we engage in, how, you know, all of those things that a society would decide are masculine or feminine.
Mm-hmm. And then you also used, Kelly, the term cisgender. What does that mean?
I think Angela actually used cisgender. Yeah. But yeah, cisgender is when your gender identity matches the sex that you were assigned at birth. And then gender nonconforming can be when your gender expression differs from your gender identity. And then we've got a lot of folks that identify as non-binary or gender fluid or gender queer. And so that can mean different things to different people. Sometimes that means that folks feel that they have both feminine and masculine within them. Mm-hmm. But some folks feel like they have neither, that they're outside of the gender construct. And so it kind of really depends on the person and why, like how they're using that phrase.
And all of this is entirely different from sexual orientation.
Correct.
Exactly.
So can you speak to that for people who are confused by that?
Sure. So sexual orientation or sexual identity is really who you love. So are mm-hmm. you attracted to males, females, both? Do you want to be in relationships with males, females, both? And so when I am trying to explain this concept to parents or to, you know, other pediatricians, really think of gender identity as who you are, and then sexual identity or sexual orientation is who you love. And so those mm-hmm. things are completely separate from each other. Even though we often say LGBTQ together to talk about the community, we're really talking about sexual identities and gender identities, and those are two different things.
And I think it's really helpful for folks to just, you know, to realize that there's more than two sexes, there's more than two genders, and there's more than two sexual orientations. And if you can be aware of that and you can be open and kind and curious and be willing to ask questions, then you're pretty much good to go. Because, I mean, it's a lot of words, it's a lot of definitions. And, you know, I don't really expect anyone to be an expert. I just hope folks are more open. And you gave me your eyebrow raised when I said more than two sexes. I'm referring to the fact that intersex is mm-hmm. also that I think 1 in 1,000 folks are usually born intersex.
And do you find that children's peers, that other children and other teenagers are more accepting of gender identity questions than adults or parents or family members can be?
I think it depends on the concept, on the context, whether peers are more accepting. What I think is probably universally true is that peers are more knowledgeable or mm-hmm. they are more familiar with concepts than mm-hmm. parents. They have been frequently asked to define their pronouns or asked to define their sexual and gender identities. And so I think they're more familiar with the concept, but that doesn't necessarily always translate into being more affirming or supportive.
I want to ask about about pronouns, choosing to use or choosing not to use he or she, but preferring they. So a lot of people now use this even in their email signatures. A lot of adults will use that. So explain the significance of using the correct or the preferred pronoun.
Well, I think all of us want to be referred to in the way that we see ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so when you're misgendered or when someone uses an incorrect pronoun for you, it feels like you're not being seen, feels like you're invisible. And it's a really invalidating experience. So I think to be able to have a pronoun that reflects your identity, whether that's he, she, or they, is really important. Mm-hmm. I think to all of us, you know, those of us who are cisgender and those of us who are trans and gender diverse.
But isn't that, do you find it's commonly difficult for parents? Because, you know, you think about the birth, it's a boy, mm-hmm. it's a girl. And you've had this, you know, maybe if we're talking about adolescence, you've had 10, 11, 12 years of thinking of your child as a girl or a boy. So how can parents navigate that change?
It is hard for parents. And, you know, I like to think all parents want what's best for their kids. And all parents, I think, love their kids unconditionally. So I usually start there with parents. And I think that, you know, our brains are wired to bias us. So they take shortcuts our brain takes shortcuts all the time to make life easier for us. And pronouns is one of those shortcuts. And so mm-hmm. when you're used to using a certain pronoun for someone for a decade of their life, particularly if they're your own child, it can be hard to switch, but we can do it and parents can do it. And it sometimes takes time and often takes patience and understanding on the part of the whole family to get there. But it can be done. And I think what I've seen working with families is even if at an initial appointment, they're going back and forth between pronouns when they're referring to their child, over time, it becomes easier for the parent to use the pronoun that their child is using for themselves.
And Kelly, what have you seen in the classroom, your years as a teacher working with students, when the pronoun is not right?
I agree. I think it's really hard for students when you're not calling them what they know that they are. Mm-hmm. It's the same as using a student's chosen name and making sure that you're being respectful of who a child is. And this comes back to my original thing about how kids deserve a safe environment and they deserve to feel like they matter. And by calling a student the correct name and using the correct pronouns and their chosen pronouns, then you're showing that respect and you're going to make a student feel like they matter. I understand I'm an English teacher. I understand that they is a transition because it's a plural usually and not a singular pronoun. And I think, you know, one of the ways that I think about it is some students who use they, it's because they have both masculine and feminine attributes. And so they is actually two. And so mm-hmm. calling that student they, like, I don't know if that helps educators at all, but it really is just about respect and learning how people want to be referred to, because it's also educators mm-hmm. in our schools who are using they or, you know, have chosen names that we need to make sure that we're being respectful of.
I want to take a moment to talk about the work that each of you is doing. And so, Dr. Gepford, we introduced you as being the medical director for the Center for Gender Health at Children's Minnesota. This is a fairly new service that's being offered at Children's Minnesota. Explain the work that you are doing.
Sure. So in the gender health program, we're an exclusively pediatric multi-specialty program. So within the program, there's myself as a pediatrician. We have two pediatric endocrinologists and a pediatric gynecologist, as well as our social worker, who's a clinical social worker that does care navigation, can do some assessment services, and really helps families navigate the complex situations that they're in. And so our role as a clinic is really to help families ask questions and learn more about their kids. So we do initial gender consultations for families, for kids of all ages. And then we can do medical treatments as appropriate, depending on the age of the child and the readiness of the family.
And mental health services. is part of what is offered there, because there's counseling that goes into this.
Yeah, so in our clinic, we don't specifically have integrated mental health services, but we do help connect families with mental health support because it is really important for kids. And honestly, in the work I do for parents, I mean, parents are often struggling. And so getting families access to family therapy support, whether that be support groups or a specific family therapist, can be really important, as well as kids who are needing support as they go through questioning their gender identity and figuring out their identities.
I read that 40% of transgender or gender nonconforming people have attempted suicide. That's according to national surveys. And does that come up in conversation as you're talking to families about their concerns with their child?
Absolutely. A lot of parents come in very scared because they've read that statistic. So we know that trans and gender diverse kids are 8 to 9 times more likely to attempt suicide than their peers. And parents know this, and so they come in because they want to make sure that their child doesn't end up being one of those statistics. So they're very aware of that, and they're very afraid of that. I've also often seen patients in clinic who've made suicide attempts or have struggled with suicidality, and so that's on a lot of parents' minds, and it's on my mind as we try to keep kids safe and really make sure that they feel affirmed and supported and not go to those hopeless places.
Mm-hmm. And Kelly, in that same article I was reading, it talked about school bullying. That school bullying is cited as playing a significant role. And what have you seen with that?
Well, the HRC just came out with a report that 74% of LGBTQ kids don't feel safe at school. 74%. So yes, bullying, harassment.
They're going to get beat up.
Beat up, or even the words hurt too. Mm-hmm. You know, not being supported, being called names. And educators who maybe aren't as well informed about this information and maybe are inadvertently doing things that are hurting kids too.
Ignoring the bullying or also the words that they choose to use.
Yep. And even, you know, when you can create curriculum that includes the voices of LGBTQ people, research has shown that when you can see yourself in the curriculum, you can see yourself in the schools, that you're more successful. And when teachers introduce themselves and share their pronouns, it creates that space for students to know that someone's safe that I can talk to.
So like in the beginning of the school year, I'm Mrs. Drew. This is English, and my pronouns are she and her.
Mm-hmm.
So that sends a message.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Even this week, someone reached out to me, and a teacher, you know, shared her pronouns. And then in the Get to Know You activity, one of the seventh graders said, I prefer they, them. So it creates this space, and it lets kids know that that's a safe person they can talk to.
You see me.
Mm-hmm. You see me.
And one thing that I might add, too, and, you know, my work with parents and it came to mind as Kelly was talking, is that sometimes families are not safe spaces for kids either. I think about 70% of kids have heard their families make anti-LGBTQ remarks as well. It came out of that same study. But the really great news is that families, when they are affirming and supportive, can be a great source of protection for kids. And we know that kids who have a single caring adult who support their identities have protection against almost all of the negative outcomes that we see.
Because as a child, I know at the end of the school day, I can go to Kelly, I can go to my cousin, I can go to my mom or dad or grandma and have this conversation and talk with them about how I was feeling.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking about having conversations about gender identity and why it's important to have an understanding of it. If you want to share in the conversation, we have a pediatrician here. We have an advocate here from Outfront, Minnesota, and a former school teacher. Give us a call. The number is 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me. I'm at Angela Davis, NPR. And we do have some listeners who are on hold because we've talked about just the high number of suicide attempts by transgender youth. I want to make sure that we remind people that if you are thinking about suicide or you know someone who is, that you can always send a message to the crisis text line. And so you can just text to 741-741. You can also reach out to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and that's a toll-free number. It is 800-273-TALK. Again, that's 800-273-TALK, and that talk is 8255. Let's bring in some of our listeners this morning. In St. Paul, Jenny's on hold. Jenny's listening. Good morning, Jenny.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just want to first thank you for taking my call and for having this conversation. I work for an organization called AmazeWorks, where we focus on providing resources and training specifically for teachers to create conditions of belonging in their classrooms and schools. So I'm quite passionate about this conversation to begin with, and I believe it's a really important one. I'd like to add that as we continue to have these conversations, hopefully more and more often, we also need to take a deeper dive into the conversation of acceptance as compared to tolerance. So it seems to me that many of our schools, for a variety of reasons, are still at that level of tolerance, especially the 74% of LGBTQ students who still don't feel safe. And so I'm just wondering what your guests have to say about the difference between tolerance and acceptance, and where bias, both implicit and explicit bias, play a role in that, and anti-bias education, and how we can create those conditions of belonging, especially for our students who have healthy, complex identities.
Okay, that's Ginny in St. Paul. Multiple questions there, but she uses these two terms. There's tolerance, and then there's acceptance. What's the difference? What do you see there in the difference between tolerance and acceptance?
Well, I would probably define tolerance as, you know, that you're putting up with something you don't like very much. So if
how would I know that? How would I see? Just your facial expression?
Facial expression, the way that's, you know, persistently misgendering someone and not making an effort to get it right. Maybe making side comments about someone's identity that aren't, you know, directly an insult, but indicate that you're not on board. And so I think of tolerance as sort of putting up with something you don't like, like being in a room with a bad smell that you can't get out of, you know, and you kind of, that's how you're approaching the world. And I feel like acceptance is embracing. It's really celebrating the differences that we have between us and celebrating the difference of someone who's transgender, gender diverse, and really making an effort to learn and understand them and make sure that you're being a part of creating a positive environment for them rather than just tolerating their presence.
And I think one of my mantras as Teacher of the Year was every heart matters. And I think if you lead with your heart and you lead with compassion and you want to make sure that every single kid feels like they matter, then that goes even beyond acceptance. That goes into seeing the student, seeing their heart, seeing what they need, helping them be successful, seeing them as individual humans. And that's about, I like your word, celebration. That's about celebrating who they are, which to me is even more important than even just acceptance.
She also asked about how do we move from tolerance to acceptance, ways to do that. So acknowledgement.
I think one of the big jobs of, as an educator for me has been to look at my own biases. She talked about implicit and explicit mm-hmm. biases and the ways those are coming out and making sure that your belief system is aligned with your behavior, or it's like you said, people can tell if it's not. And so really doing the work as educators to figure out where our own biases are, because we have them, and looking in the mirror and doing that work to make sure that we are serving the needs of every student.
Another listener who's holding on is Nicole in Minneapolis. And Minneapolis, Nicole, go ahead with your question.
Hi. So I am involved with an organization called Transforming Families Minnesota. It supports transgender youth and their families a lot of times through peer support groups. I facilitate a peer support group for transgender teenagers in Minneapolis. And coming back to that statistic about how, you know, there's a suicidality rate of 40% amongst transgender youth. It also includes transgender youth and beyond transgender people in general. And how an accepting adult can diminish that suicide rate down to near the peers of transgender youth. And I've got a friend, Dave, who is raising a transgender child and also advocates for transgender youth. And his question that he asked in his advocacy and continues to ask is, if 4 out of 10 children are attempting or contemplating suicide in a particular group, like, if that's not enough for us to change how we approach the issue, then how many children, you know, what percentage of kids have to attempt or consider suicidality before we change what we're doing? So I guess that's one thing to keep in mind is what's keeping us from making these changes when those statistics exist, when we can see that, you know, being accepting and when we can see that using honoring names and pronouns can have such dramatic impacts, what's stopping us from doing the things that we know will save lives?
Thank you. That's Nicole. What's holding us back? We've had information. We've heard from the children and teenagers and their families themselves. What's getting in the way?
I think fear for some folks. I think when you don't understand something, it makes you afraid. And for some folks, that comes out through words and that comes out through actions. I can speak to my own experiences. There's a lot of folks who don't get me. I don't look like they think I'm supposed to get or supposed to look. I've been spit on in a Target parking lot. My wife and I were walking. I've had, you know, things said to me. I've been hit in the head. I've been, you know, both. And then as a kid, I was spit on. I was kicked. People are afraid of what they don't understand. And so, again, I think it's hoping that more folks are willing to look at those fears and be courageous, because our LGBTQ folks need that from us.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Fairmont, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, the teachers who were more than just tolerating me, the teachers who were more than just accepting me, the teachers who were celebrating me, I remember them. I remember Mrs. Theed in fifth grade who saw me, who I was, you know, and it made me want to learn everything she ever taught me, because I felt seen and I felt like I mattered. And Mr. Hartshorn and Mr. Gorath and these, you know, beautiful teachers, school was a really safe place for me. And the teachers who saw me and celebrated me and like that saved my life.
Yeah, and I would probably echo exactly what Kelly said. I think it's fear that holds a lot of people back. And I think it's fear of what you don't understand and fear of the unknown. And what I see with parents a lot is it's fear for their child's future. And so I think a lot of parents are afraid of what having a transgender child might mean for their family, for their child. And I have a firm belief that all parents want what's best for their kids. And all parents want their children to feel loved and accepted and supported. And I think when I have been perplexed by families' reactions, I think it does come back to fear. And I think that parents are often afraid of what a life might look like for their transgender child. And so I think the more that we can create a society that's really accepting of transgender and gender diverse kids and families and really celebrates their identities, I think that will go a long way. And I do just want to give a shout out to Transforming Families. It's a really great organization, and we refer a lot of families there who are struggling and needing to connect with other parents, wanting their kids to connect with their kids. So really appreciative for that organization.
Very powerful when you meet other parents who are going through similar challenges.
Absolutely. It can be really isolating for families, especially in more rural communities, when they feel like they don't have anyone else to talk to about what their family's going through.
And I want to mention, too, that Outfront Minnesota, which, you know, I'm lucky enough to work for, is doing a lot of work across the state. And so if folks are confused about this or need support, we have an anti-violence program, we have a policy and organizing program, and then we have the educational equity program. And, you know, we're really trying to help LGBTQ folks and allies get what they need to feel safe, to thrive, to feel celebrated.
Do you send speakers out across the state to talk to groups who invite them?
We sure do.
Okay. Right now, I want to go right back to the phone lines in Minneapolis. Steve is listening. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Hi, go right ahead with your story or your question.
And my pronoun I identify as they. As do our children. I'm me and my wife are raising my children to not fall into the social constructs which include gender. You know, we've preached to them that they have been born, you know, just perfect how they are, and that there's absolutely nothing wrong with them to change. There's nothing strange about them at all. You know, and we kind of reinforce that gender doesn't matter, that their gender was left, you know, at the hospital where they were born, and that these social constructs, including gender, are not real, and that they're not what or who they are. They're not defined by them. And that to fight, you know, against being, you know, falling into these constructs, you know, they're not black, they're not white, they're not gay, they're not straight, you know, they're not a boy or a girl, you know, if anything, they're a human being. And even that is a label that, you know, definitely we're working on that conversation. But to not define themselves or limit themselves by these labels. And so, you know, there are challenges with that and sort of raising them in a community school. I mean, you go to Target, the playground where people are identifying through these social constructs. How do they navigate that world? You know, and they're pretty respectful children, but Is there a space for them in this topic?
That is Steve in Minneapolis. So he has he says that they are raising their kids to really not conform to any traditional genders.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a space for all kids. I mean, that's mm-hmm. kind of our message, is that we want all kids and families to feel, you know, loved and supported and celebrated for who they are. So I think there's definitely a space for all kids. I recognize the challenge there. We live in a very binary world. You know, I often, when I'm talking with other clinicians about this topic, will use my own children as an example. I have three kids, 5, 5, and 3, and they, you know, understand the world around them and understand what our boy clothes and girl clothes, and that's not how we talk about it. We say clothes are for everybody, but they
in the stores,
they know.
They're labeled. There's
right.
the boys section, there's the girls section.
Or I often give the example at Target, you know, they took boys and girls toys off the aisles signs a few years ago, but if you go to the toy aisle at Target, and you can very clearly tell what the girl aisle is and the boy just by looking down the aisle, you can see what's in there. And so, you know, kids are, I describe them as always reading gender scripts, so they're always looking to the world around them, and they're looking for how people are expressing gender, and they're assigning and sort of figuring that out. And I think the one sort of thing that gives me hope for Steve's kids is that I do think that kids, as they go through identity development, do settle into who they are, and all kids will find who they are. So I think that, you know, as Steve's kids are navigating this complex world and being given permission to find themselves, they will, and they will hopefully, with the support of their parents, be able to assert themselves, whether they identify as cisgender boys or girls, or, you know, gender nonconforming, somewhere in between. However they identify, I think they will get there. And it sounds like they have some really great supportive parents who will affirm their identities when they do.
And I think it's important to not reject feminine or masculine. There are some folks who really embrace different elements of that. I love to watch The Bachelor and talk about my feelings. And I also love to wear a three-piece suit. And so I would really, I guess, you know, ask Steve to also consider that gender's on a spectrum. And I really like that he supports his kids to, you know, be themselves, but that it's also okay if you have a little boy who loves Barbies or trucks, or if you have a little girl that loves the, you know, that it's okay. It's okay for kids to gravitate toward certain toys. I think that, you know, Angela and I are just asking parents and educators to be really open and curious and allow the child to pick what they're drawn to instead of kind of dictating that for them.
Can we talk about bathrooms and what we've seen in schools and in businesses as well? The men's and women's room. We've seen now unisex bathrooms, or just bathrooms that have, you know, no labels, like, here's a bathroom, it's clean, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Like, the significance or the problems that can occur not being able to go to a bathroom that you feel comfortable with. I read a story of a 13-year-old, and he tried to explain to his parents that when he's confronted with the bathroom, he just doesn't know which way to go. And so would avoid eating, avoid drinking, so that he could go to the bathroom at home.
And I wish I could say that that were a rare story. There are a lot of our students who are trans or non-binary or gender non-conforming who are not going to the bathroom all day because they don't feel safe. And that's, I mean, as a pediatrician, you know.
Don't feel safe in the bathroom. What would happen there?
There can be bullying, a lot of bullying for kids that are in the bathroom that the other kids perceive that they shouldn't be, or that the adults perceive they shouldn't be. And there have been a lot of cases of that where adults are yelling at kids for being in the wrong bathroom. And just the bathroom access issue is, you know, there's a lawsuit happening in Minnesota right now around that. Mm-hmm. And so this is a big issue. And I think a lot of it is making sure that, again, we're creating a safe environment for students to get their, you know, biological needs met, and including emotional. But in this case, we're talking about biological needs, and asking the student, you know, what bathroom do you feel the most comfortable in, and then creating an environment where that's safe. Some students do want to use like a single stall bathroom. Some schools are putting in family bathrooms. Some schools are putting in, you know, non-gendered bathrooms. And different kids are going to want to use different situations depending on their own situation. And so making sure that school administrators are supportive of what kids need.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we all have a right to pee. So I think, you know, that's what it comes down to for kids, is every kid should be able to go to the bathroom when they need to go to the bathroom, and they should feel safe going to the bathroom. And I think there's a lot of you know, sort of media hype that gets sort of generated around, if we let transgender people in the bathroom, then the bathroom's not going to be safe for people who are cisgender. And the reality is that it is transgender and gender diverse kids who are being harassed in bathrooms mm-hmm. and who are avoiding bathrooms because they don't feel safe. And in the HRC study that Kelly referenced earlier, 66% of kids, so 2/3 of kids, will avoid going to the bathroom all day long because they, of trans and gender diverse kids, because they don't feel like it's, there's a bathroom for them to go to, or that it's safe for them to go to the bathroom. And, you know, again, with 3 kids of my own, I would hate to feel that they're not going to the bathroom all day long at school. I mean, and as a pediatrician, absolutely, that causes health problems. And we see that a lot. And transgender adults are more likely to have urinary tract infections and other problems related to their urologic health because they are avoiding public restrooms.
Kelly, I want to ask you, why did you leave the classroom and choose to do the work that you're doing now at OutFront?
Angela, I think my classroom just got bigger. and that's how I see it, because I'm still an educator. I have the opportunity to work with educators across the state and with educational leaders and how to be more LGBTQ inclusive and how to, you know, support them in their efforts with educational equity. So I wasn't looking to leave Takata Learning Center. It's an amazing school that I helped to open and design and create, and I love it. I love the kids there. I actually miss them quite a bit. But I was given this opportunity to keep going with the work I started as Teacher of the Year to, again, really help support educators to support kids, and I couldn't turn it down.
And I know I visited your classroom when I was working as a television reporter when you were named Teacher of the Year, and I saw just the great affection your students have for you. So, you know, part of me makes me sad that students don't get to see you every day, but yes, you have a much larger audience. Do you find that your personal experience, some of your personal pain, that has made it helpful for you to communicate with people because you can sort of share your own story and trying to make points about maybe studies or research or stats, but this is what I know because this is what I've lived?
I have received that feedback that it makes it more accessible. I'm not just coming at people with all this information, but helping them understand how this work actually impacts people like me and my experiences as a kid and as an educator. I had some schools that were really supportive, and I had some schools where I had some really, you know, gender and homophobic situations that were traumatic for me. And so part of my goal is to also provide that support for other educators. We now have an LGBTQ educator network in Minnesota, because when you're the only out teacher, it's very isolating. We have had suicides in Minnesota of out educators within the last few years and before that. And I just really want educators to feel like they're not alone, because they matter too.
I want to go back to our phone lines in St. Paul. Kat is listening. Good morning, Kat.
Hi.
Go ahead. So we can hear you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I wanted to point out that your previous caller, you've been misgendering them in your conversation. They, at the beginning of that, identified themselves clearly as they. And
I corrected myself. Yes. Yeah, I did correct myself to say they. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. It has been all of your guests, and I think...
Thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you. And an important conversation to have as a person who also identifies as non-binary listening to this conversation specifically. It was hard to hear someone be misgendered on air. And it's an experience I've had many times calling in to NPR, even when I've specifically identified myself. I do also want to say that bathroom, you know, problems are not just bullying. And I think bullying is an incredibly important thing to be talking about. And I think we also need to understand that it escalates to physical harm, and physical harm that can land people in hospitals. Like, I choose where I go to the bathroom, not because I'm afraid of my feelings being hurt or afraid of negative interactions, but because I'm afraid of beatings, and I'm afraid of being violently ejected from spaces where I've chosen to place myself. I think it is a thing that in conversations with people, they don't seem to understand where the kind of escalation point is. And they're worried that we're afraid of being, you know, looked at or being shamed publicly. And while those are incredibly hard things to deal with, and I don't want to devalue them, it's also important to recognize that trans women get killed every month in this country, and non-binary people are assaulted. And it's not just adults, it's children too. And the stakes are very, very high.
Can you remind me what pronouns you use? Did you say?
They, them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is Kat in St. Paul. So, yeah, she speaks, or Kat speaks to, they speaks to. It is a new way of thinking. And even, you know, for me, it's something I have to really think about and then mentally make a change. So I'm glad we're having the conversation. I'm glad even that I am an example of that, because my intent, and I don't think it's anyone's intent, is to ever hurt anyone's feelings. Mm-hmm. That no one gets up in the morning like, I'm going to offend someone. But there it takes, for many of us, it takes some time, because it's a new way of thinking and it's a new way of talking.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good reminder that that we're not perfect, and it's a good reminder to just apologize and mm-hmm. and correct and move on. And I want to speak to what Kat said, and they're right that folks are being harmed, and you know, especially our trans people of color are being murdered at rates that are abysmal. When you have that intersectional connection of both being trans and a person of color, these folks are, it's horrible what's happening. And I agree. I mean, as someone who has been physically harmed for being gender nonconforming, I agree with what Kat is saying, and it's a good point.
And I think it's just a good reminder of how high the stakes are, that, you know, for those folks for whom this is a new conversation, it can feel really uncomfortable, and there's a discomfort that comes with it. But, you know, our discomfort is a small price to pay for someone else's safety and for someone else's well-being. And so I think it's just a good reminder of how high the stakes can be. And so, you know, I appreciate Kat for calling in and raising that issue.
I want to talk more about the services there at Children's Minnesota, the Center for Gender Health. And I'm looking at some of the services, and some of these are new concepts to me, too. So if you have a young child, that there are some medical treatments that can help the child deal with having, I guess, issues like, for instance, menstruation. There's a menstrual suppression treatment. Can you talk about some of that, as well as there's a, how do I pronounce this? Pubertal suppression?
Yes, pubertal suppression.
Pubertal suppression, menstrual suppression, gender-affirming hormone treatments. What are these treatments?
Yeah, so, you know, really, so you mentioned young kids, and really for young kids, we don't do any medical intervention. So for mm-hmm. kids who are pre-pubertal, which is going to be most kids under the age of about 11, there's no medical interventions for kids. And what we're really doing is helping families have conversations around understanding their children's identities. We give the message of support without steering. So really letting a child lead with their identity, not steering them in one direction or the other, but really following a child's lead when it comes to how they identify and how they want to express that through clothes and toys and peer preferences. And then as children approach puberty, then that's when we can have conversations about medical intervention. And so the puberty suppression that you mentioned is an option that we have to basically pause puberty for those kids who are transgender, gender nonconforming, so that they don't go through a biologic puberty that is incongruent with their gender identity. So if they're identifying as a boy and they're about to get their, you know, period or start developing breasts, then we have the option to pause that for them. And it's a nice option because it's a reversible treatment for kids that can be done. And then you mentioned the menstrual suppression, which is basically suppressing menses or periods for kids who are assigned female at birth. And that's an option after kids start to get their period, if it becomes distressing for them, because if you identify as a boy mm-hmm. and you're getting a period every month, that can be pretty distressing. We can suppress that. And we do that through using things that are commonly used for contraception, such as an IUD or birth control pills, the Nexplanon implant, things like that. So these are, you know, things that are being used for contraception, and we're just using them with the effect of suppressing periods.
And doctor, I'm sure as a parent, I'm sure some of the most common questions you have about these treatments, are they safe?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the puberty suppression that I referenced earlier is a treatments we've been using for a very long time in kids who go through puberty too early, a condition mm-hmm. called precocious puberty. So we've been using those medications for a very long time to treat kids with early puberty. And so it's the same medication, same safety. And for the menstrual suppression, again, these are contraceptive, so it's as safe as using contraception.
Kelly, what do you think about that, knowing that there are some medical treatments that can delay puberty or delay breast developing or delay, I guess, what with body hair
yeah.
until a young person can manage it? Like, or what do you think about that these are offerings?
I really appreciate that you opened your center in April, because there are a lot of students who have needed that support, have needed that medical intervention, or just even the information to be able to have the options. Because there are a lot of really good doctors out there, but sometimes they don't have the same level of information that you have and the same level of expertise. And for students and families to be able to have that resource and have those options, I think is amazing.
And what has been the feedback? I'm curious, as people, because this center just opened in April of this year.
Correct.
As people learn about the Center for Gender Health at Children's, what kind of feedback are you getting from the community?
Yeah, we've had a really overwhelmingly positive response, both from parents and families, community members, the community at Children's Minnesota, and I would just say the pediatric community in the Twin Cities as a whole. Folks are really have been eager to have a place for trans and gender diverse kids to go to get healthcare, and also a resource for their own education and training. So we've had a lot of pediatric and family practice clinics reach out wanting to learn more about how to provide better primary care for trans and gender diverse kids and really wanting to learn how to be more accepting and supportive of kids in their own practice.
And there are not that many centers in the country like
Correct.
This.
So right? We're one of about a dozen exclusively pediatric multi-specialty mm-hmm. gender health programs in the country that are located at a children's hospital. So there's not a lot. And in this region, they're really... wasn't a program specifically like this that was at a children's hospital and exclusively pediatric with multiple subspecialists.
I want to bring in another one of our listeners. This is Grant in St. Paul. Good morning, Grant.
Hey, good morning. How are you all?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Good. I just wanted to, I'm an educator. I happen to be on the way to a family funeral, so I'm able to listen in, and I'm glad that I was, because the conversation from tolerance to acceptance speaks to me. I'm a Spanish teacher, and I have this beautiful gift of being able to make my curriculum about my students. And so as we are learning, we're learning colors, numbers, et cetera, that you would learn in first year Spanish, but we're learning it in the context of who is actually in the room in front of us, and then holding my other students accountable for knowing details about the students in the room has really changed the fabric of my classroom. And I think that when we think about changing the fabric of society, it's a long-term goal that really starts in school. So co-creating curriculum with my students is one of those things that's really helped people belong, even in the context of Spanish, which is a very binary language that, you know, people are working on it, but it's still very binary.
All right. That is Grant in St. Paul, a Spanish teacher. So as we get into the classroom, again, what are some things that teachers, as they approach the school year, that they can do to be more conscious of gender identity and not cause any unnecessary stress or pain?
I think one of the big ways is, again, to be curious instead of judgmental. So not making assumptions when students tell you stories about their lives, about who their parents are, who they maybe went on a date with, what pronouns that they use. Again, introducing yourself with chosen pronouns, using gender-inclusive language, so calling your students folks or humans or learners, not having them line up by gender, but maybe instead by birthday or last name.
That happens with young kids, right?
Mm-hmm. And speaking out against bullying, displaying posters and art that represent, you know, people of different genders so that kids can see themselves, but then other kids can see that there are a lot of different kind of folks in the world. And then the bathroom access and recognizing that families are diverse in structure and, again, using that inclusive, non-gendered terms like caregivers and guardians instead of mom and dad.
And when, you know, when children are young, we take them to the pediatrician for the well baby visits. And mm-hmm. then, you know, as they get older, for their annual exams. So is that a conversation that parents can have or the child should be having with their primary care physician or their pediatrician when they start to ask questions about their gender?
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally if you have a child who is asking questions about their gender identity, the first conversation would happen in the pediatrician's office. And hopefully more and more pediatricians are feeling comfortable having that conversation. But if they don't, or if they're looking for a place to send parents to have the conversation, that's what we hope to provide at, you know, in our gender health program, is just a place to have a conversation. And, you know, again, we're not attached to any specific outcome or intervention for any kids or families that come to see us, but really making sure that families have a safe and understanding place to have a conversation and ask questions.
And immediately following a bad experience, what, as a caring adult, what can you say to a child after, you know, there's been misgendering or if there's been a bullying? What can you do to provide comfort in the immediate time following that?
I think one step before that is knowing that as adults, if a kid approaches us or and they want to talk about this kind of stuff, that we have a choice. We can either ignore it and pretend like it's going to go away, but it's not. And what you've done then is decrease your opportunity to connect with that student. So, you know, if students know that you're safe and they approach you, asking them how they feel, making sure that you're showing them that you feel differently, that you support them and you see them and you care about them.
All right. Our time is up, but I want to thank our guest today as we had this conversation that hopefully was helpful to many people. It was helpful to me. Kelly Holstein, Director of Educational Equity at Outfront, and most recently, an English teacher, as well as Dr. Angela Kate Gepford at Children's Minnesota Center for Gender Health.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@mpr.org.